Putin's gamble backfires today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Kremlin expels hundreds of U.S. diplomats, but the real loser could be Vladimir Putin.
Putin's gamble, and it was a massive gamble in 2016 to put his thumb on the scale and throw his weight behind Donald Trump, is backfiring.
And later, a young man leaves his home in England to go join ISIS in Syria. He stays in touch with his family via phone calls and Skype. But at one point, his mom noticed a change in him.
Something had started to kind of feed into him that actually he wasn't 100%, because quite often these jihadis and these fighters see things very black and white, and he was beginning to start to see grey again.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here on this Monday. Seems like he just got here, but Anthony Scaramucci is out. President Trump has fired his communications chief at the request of his new chief of staff, John Kelly. We'll hear more about all this later in the show. But first, Russian President Vladimir Putin. He's been doing some removing of his own. Putin says the U.S. has to cut its diplomatic staff in Russia by 755. That's in retaliation for new U.S. sanctions on Russia. It's a large and precise number for sure, 755. It includes staff at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and consulates across Russia.
They're going to be hobbled in their daily functioning.
Julia Yaffe writes for The Atlantic and has covered Russia for years.
And I think it will also affect Russians who, for example, want to come to the U.S. for vacation or trips. There's a lot of that. They'll have to wait longer for visas. All those kinds of consular affairs will just take longer.
And then there's what this embassy punishment means for U.S.-Russia relations.
It means that Putin's gamble, and it was a massive gamble in 2016 to put his thumb on the scale and throw his weight behind Donald Trump, is backfiring, that there's a kind of fundamental misunderstanding of how the American system works on the Russian side, that even with all the powers that an American president has, even if you manage to elect somebody who promises friendlier relationship with Russia and with Vladimir Putin, that they can't do it alone. And if the Congress and the national security foreign policy establishment are against you and suspect that you're doing this for nefarious means, that they will be able to stymie you.
President Trump has talked a lot about improving relations with Russia. I mean, it's kind of hard to know in the midst of multiple investigations into Russia what improving relations really means. But is this move by the Kremlin a sign that improving relations is at right now kind of a non-starter?
I think it's from both sides. It means it's a non-starter. American foreign policy establishment, Congress, are clearly sending a signal that after Russia meddled in our elections, you know, which is the unanimous consensus of the American intelligence community, it would be weird to try to improve relations with Russia now. Moreover, there has to be a goal, right? The good relations with another country are never the goal or the end. They're the means to achieving an end. And it's unclear what we would need Russia for other than preventing them from playing the spoiler, for example, in Afghanistan, where they're arming the Taliban, or in North Korea, where they're empowering the Kim Jong-un regime. So, you know, do we want friendlier relationship with Russia to make them stop playing spoiler? You know, again, after they've meddled in our election, that's a hard sell. From the Russian side, Vladimir Putin and in turn the Russian political establishment, the Russian press, have insisted that the Americans have just gone crazy. Putin's spokesman today called it political schizophrenia. And I think for Russians, it also doesn't make sense. You know, why are we going to try to improve relations with this country that's blaming us for their own internal political mess?
So everybody's pointing fingers and just, I mean, the whole idea of pursuing friendly relations. I mean, what about just practical relations right now? You mentioned the Taliban, North Korea, just simple diplomatic communications. That's going to be really hard with all these people eliminated from the U.S. embassy.
Well, it was already hard. The Russians were complaining that because of the fact that the Trump administration hasn't filled very senior policy roles at the State Department, that they were having a hard time finding people to talk to except at the highest levels. For example, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And that's probably going to continue. I think those channels are going to be open. Everything else has been kind of frozen on down.
That was Julia Yaffe with The Atlantic. Vice President Mike Pence was in Russia's backyard today in the tiny Baltic nation of Estonia. He was speaking with the presidents of the three Baltic countries, Lithuania and Latvia, as well as Estonia, about regional security. They all feel threatened by Russia, but Pence was there to reassure them.
Under President Donald Trump, the United States stands firmly behind our Article 5 pledge of mutual defense, that an attack on one of us is an attack on us all.
That's something President Trump has seemed reluctant to say, making it clear that the U.S. would defend these small NATO nations against Russian aggression. Andrew Hanna writes about Europe for Politico, and he explained to me why Estonia in particular feels so threatened.
So Estonia is directly bordering Russia, and Russia has an immense amount of forces deployed right across the border that could move at any time, theoretically, to fully occupy Estonia within 36 to 60 hours, according to a RAND study that came out last year. So Estonia has always been particularly vulnerable. You know, they were under Soviet occupation for several decades. And now that they're a member of NATO, they want to make sure that the United States' commitment to defending the Baltic states is ironclad.
Right. And Lithuania and Latvia, like Estonia, were also under Soviet occupation during the Cold War. And they all have large Russian minorities who complain of discrimination in those countries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Estonia has around 300,000 ethnic Russians. Some of these have actually become Estonian citizens, but there's a significant amount of Russians living in Estonia that are pretty much without citizenship, and the Estonian government doesn't really know what to do with these people. But there's always the fear that, similar to what Russia did with Russian-speaking populations in eastern Ukraine, they could be incited to try to support Russia's agenda, try to carve out a slice of Estonia to give a pretext for Russia to move forces in, which would be of a much more dramatic scale than what we saw in Ukraine, because even though Estonia is smaller, Estonia is a member of NATO, that could trigger the Article 5 mutual defense commitment clause.
Now, in September, Russia is staging a massive military exercise on the borders of all three countries. What is the goal of those exercises, and how anxious is it making people in Estonia?
So the Estonian government has been reaching out to the United States government and journalists like me, ringing the alarm on these exercises since back in March, I believe. That was the first time it popped up on my radar, at least. The Belarusian exercises, known as Zapad, which Russian means west, basically simulate attacking and occupying a NATO member state, specifically the Baltic states.
So if Estonia is leading the diplomatic charge here, they would seem to be really punching above their weight.
Yeah, that's what someone who was an advisor to Vice President Joe Biden told me, Michael Carpenter. He was also a Pentagon official. This country is very, very small. It's 1.3 million people. It's smaller than its other Baltic neighbors. And they don't really rely on lobbyists here in D.C. I checked the foreign agents' registration records. They really focus on face-to-face individual meetings between members of their government at all levels, mid to high level, to staffers, to aides, to officials. They really got their hands in a lot of pots here in D.C., especially, on the public speaking circuit as well. I think there is an Estonian, at least every single month, there's an Estonian official speaking in D.C. publicly.
What is your sense about Putin right now? Would he really attempt to invade Estonia based on rhetoric from Donald Trump that Trump isn't so dedicated to NATO?
Well, Vladimir Putin's very unpredictable, so I don't want to, have myself eating my words a couple months from now. But from where it stands right now, I don't think Vladimir Putin's seriously considering invading Estonia. He's coming up against some hard realities, which is that these three Baltic nations and Poland are members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and the United States will defend them if they are attacked. And unless he's willing to risk that kind of confrontation, there's not much he can do there.
Andrew Hanna of Politico there, joining us from Washington. Let's take a break for a second and talk about soccer, because this happened last weekend. That right there is the sound of the first goal ever scored by a female soccer player in Mexico's new women's league. Yup, Liga MX Femenil kicked off its first games over the weekend. And what it means is that now professional women's soccer players in Mexico have a league to play in. It is pretty exciting stuff, but the new soccer league has not been without controversy. Emily Green in Mexico City has been following the story.
Soccer here is a massive deal. You see it in the bars everywhere, and people are just obsessed with it, except it's a really a man's sport. So to have it be extended to women is massive, and it's massive on a sports level, of course, but also in terms of gender equality. And what I understand is that this is the first professional women's sports league in Mexico, not just wow. soccer. And so we're really talking in terms of a big step towards gender equality. It's a big deal.
So soccer, as we know, is huge in Mexico, but as you say, it's also a man's game, which may be part of the answer to the question, why hasn't there been an all-female soccer league in Mexico before? But soccer's huge there, so why not?
This is still a machista society, and I think that women's sports aren't afforded the same respect. I opened the sports section of a newspaper on Saturday, and the news of the inauguration of the Women's Soccer League was buried in the sports section. In some ways, this Women's Professional Soccer League in Mexico is a bigger deal internationally than here in Mexico, which is disappointing, but that doesn't take away the fact that it's a big deal. I will also say that in the United States, getting a professional women's soccer league up and going has been difficult. It's been attempted three times. We're now in our third different league in the United States. So no matter where, whether Mexico or the U.S., it's a difficult challenge, but definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, no, that's a good point about what it's taken to get a women's soccer league going in the U.S. But it is, as you say, a huge step forward for equality in sports. Then there are these controversies surrounding the Liga MX Femenil. For one, only native Mexicans will be allowed to play, not even dual citizens. Can you just help us understand the logic behind this decision?
Yes, I have to say it's a little odd. Mexican Americans and dual citizens can play on the Mexican national soccer team. That's the team that participates in the World Cup. So to say that dual citizens can't participate in La Liga here is a little odd. I think the rationale behind it is to give Mexican players born in Mexico a chance to participate. Just for comparison's sake, there are four different divisions of men's soccer leagues here in Mexico. This is the first one. So there's lots of opportunities for men to play soccer in Mexico, and dual nationals can play soccer. Dual nationals who are men can play soccer in Mexico. And I think the rationale is simply to give women Mexican soccer players a chance to play.
Yeah, and if the rule doesn't apply to men's soccer in Mexico, how are the women players feeling about it?
I think despite the double standards, they are feeling very excited. I spoke to several people, including a woman by the name of Huera Curi, who is a big advocate for soccer here in Mexico. She played soccer herself, but never got the chance to play professionally because there wasn't a professional league.
I am not scared. People tell me, like, would you consider it a failure? And for me, it's not just about opening the league and playing soccer. It's about talking to people how women deserve the same opportunities as men in sports.
Yeah. And yet other Mexican women soccer players you spoke with are really kind of struggling to figure out how they can, you know, put on the Mexican national team shirt and yet not be allowed to play in the Mexican league. Reporter Emily Green telling us about the new all-female soccer league in Mexico. Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead, a mother stays in touch when her son goes to fight with ISIS. That's coming up here on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The World in Words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Over the past few years, we've introduced you to a number of distraught parents, people whose teenage sons and daughters left home to join the ranks of ISIS. But the story of Nicola Ben-Yahia and her son Rashid, it's a little different. Even after 19-year-old Rashid left home in Birmingham, England, to fight in Syria, he kept in regular touch with his family, on the phone and on Skype. And even though Nicola Ben-Yahia was furious with her son for his decision to join ISIS, she still looked forward to those phone calls. She told me she just wanted to catch a glimpse of the boy she knew and loved.
I almost had to imagine as if he was away at college. I had to take up my mind about who he joined and where he was. Otherwise, I could not have kept so calm or kept that communication going. And then the communication was very much keeping it to actually, what did you do in your day? What did you eat? Did you sleep well? It was all the things that a mother would do as if your child was away at college. And that's how I kept the communication. And so that way he felt safe. He felt I wasn't going to judge him, and he didn't feel that I was trying to get information, although I was very, very much, but I was trying to do it very subtly.
Yeah, and then the later phone conversations, at least one of those was a Skype call, so you could see Rashid,
yeah.
And he had lost weight, he looked scruffy. How did that conversation go?
I'd asked him, this is quite later on, I mean, we'd been in communication for a few months and I didn't realise we could access Skype. So when I asked him, you know, he said, yes, of course. And I said, oh, it's fantastic, because all I'd seen is pictures of him. So to see him in this internet cafe at the back, I think it will always stay in my mind, because he was just giggling away to me, and he still had that beautiful smile and just giggling away, you know, as me and my husband were chatting away to him about our day. And that's how we kept it. We didn't talk about the situation. We tried to keep it just day to day, family, what was going on with his sisters. It will always stay in my mind and visualize him, his smile more than anything, not about his losing weight or anything, or he'd been quite scruffy and tired. It will be always his big smile that I tried to keep in my mind.
Yeah, I can imagine. Did you get a sense during any of those conversations that he wanted out? Did he ever second guess his decisions to go join ISIS?
Probably, I would say the last couple of weeks that I was in communication with him, he was very clingy with me, even more so than usual. Even though he'd have a conversation with me, he would want me to come back on the phone after his father or his sisters had spoken to him. But also then he had a conversation with his sister, and he said to his sister, his older sister, you know, if I'm wrong about this decision, ask God to guide me away from it. So it was almost like something had started to kind of feed into him that actually he wasn't 100%, because quite often these jihadis and these fighters see things very black and white, and he was beginning to start to see grey again.
Yeah, you reported your son's departure to British authorities, and they searched your home meticulously. They interrogated your family. What was that like? What sort of feelings did that stir up?
I felt like my life had just been catapulted into some awful, awful Hollywood movie. It really was. It was so surreal. You know, we had just been a normal family, going to our day-to-day jobs and just trying to be part of society. And then just to be thrown in this world that we knew nothing about. It was very, very difficult. I mean, the police, you know, and the authorities, you know, they were as respectful as they could be. And, you know, they were doing a job. They obviously needed to know what had led up to this and, you know, to prevent anybody else. And it was very difficult for them as well. But you can't even imagine having your house full of police officers constantly interviewing you and picking every word you're saying, and obviously rightly so, but very, very difficult when at the end of the day all I wanted was my son to be back with me.
So your family was told Rashid was hit by shrapnel in a coalition drone strike on the Iraqi-Syrian border in November of 2015.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to put you through this again, but can you take us back to the moment you learned that news?
I was anticipating his death. So I knew it was coming, because I knew there was very, very little chance I was going to get him out of there alive, even if he changed his mind. And then every day I would come home from work, and I remember I used to have this dread of walking into the door and waiting for my husband to tell me that he was dead. And then this particular winter's night, I remember I just had this gut feeling there was something wrong, and I walked in the door and my husband just grabbed me and held me really, really tight. And as I pulled away, he just then said, I've had the call. And as soon as he said that, he didn't have to say anything else. I knew that Rashid was dead.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in the aftermath of all this, I know you've been reaching out to other families in similar situations.
Yeah.
I don't want you to identify them, obviously, but can you tell us about one of those families that you've tried to help?
it's not actually parents quite often. A lot of siblings are reaching out, or friends of people. I find they don't know what to do, and they feel kind of a bit lost, or, you know, haven't got the same support maybe the parents have got. And so it's quite often been siblings or friends of people who've made this decision. That's what quite often I've had, really.
You know, if I stick myself in your shoes and think what it'd be like if my kid took the path Rashid took, I think I'd be going constantly through my memory bank. Like, what did I miss? How do you talk to these parents? How do you talk them down from those feelings? And how did you talk yourself down from those feelings?
You know, with families, it can be the beginning of the radicalization. It's been in the middle. It's been actually people who've actually been killed. So it's been any part of that process. Families have come to me. I always say to them, it's about actually, particularly if they're still alive, it's about keeping that those memories, because no matter what hell you're living, which you are, I think the one thing that keeps me going is the fact that I can remember him smiling at me. I kept that relationship, although I was against what he did. I was very angry with him, but I still had that connection with him. ISIS never took that away from me. They may have taken my son, but they didn't take that connection he still had with me. And that's the one thing I hold on to and try to tell families, that it is key, no matter what the outcome is that you keep that link with them.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Are there options for parents whose children have already gone to Iraq or Syria to join ISIS? I mean, they're from all over, Belgium and France. I'm thinking in particular of a German family, of the young woman found with ISIS in Mosul. She's 16. Yeah. How can those parents help their kids?
It's very difficult. And the families, the parents are going to need a huge amount of support, because, you know, we have people who have gone to Syria and they're still out there, or whether they're returnees. You know, they're going to, like the young girl, is going to probably face, you know, sort of a prison sentence. And so families are still always going to have that relationship with that individual. So it's key to absolutely support and strengthen the families with how to deal with this, and the knowledge and skills that they need to keep going, not just months, but years.
So ISIS has been pushed out of Mosul. The end game seems near in Raqqa, the ISIS de facto capital. Some of the foreign fighters in those cities might now use the opportunity, though, to leave the extremists. Should they be permitted to go home? And how worried are you by the idea and what might happen if they do go home?
There was always the threat. Even 2 years ago, when my son went away, the police talked about him returning and being fearful of returnees. We do need to be worried. And the thing is, we also need to bring them back and to know where they are, because what's going to happen if we ignore them and just don't, you know, get them to come back? They're going to go underground. And that's a lot scarier. And how are you going to deal with that if they're underground?
Nicola Ben-Yahia's son, Rashid, died fighting with ISIS. She's created a group called Families for Life that focuses on de-radicalization and support for families of those recruited by extremists. Nicola, thank you very much for telling us your story.
No, thank you.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a Muslim writer talks about how Jesus appears in Islamic scripture.
When you read the Quran, you read about the miracles, you read about the virgin birth. You read that Jesus was the Word of God, a very powerful term. He was the Messiah. These are emphasized.
That story just ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Mooch is out. Anthony Scaramucci's tenure as White House Communications Director lasted just 10 days. President Trump is reportedly removing him from the post at the request of John Kelly, who became Trump's new chief of staff this morning. The White House said that as the new chief of staff, Kelly needs a clean slate. Kelly himself came in as chief of staff after Reince Priebus was removed just Friday, and that was preceded by Scaramucci's profanity-laced rant against Priebus, which, hard to believe, was just 4 days ago. David Rennie has not been hired or fired this week, but he is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. You still have your job, right, David?
Yeah, probably by not working in the West Wing.
So this looks like the chaos to the casual observer. How would you characterize it?
Well, I mean, it clearly isn't great to lose your guy in a kind of bloodbath way. I think that there is some optimism you can see among observers who want the Trump administration to start getting a little less chaotic, that maybe this means the new chief of staff, General Kelly, has some juice. Clearly, he demanded this this resignation. He got it. And that, you know, that proves that maybe this tough Marine general has some control over the system. I think what was interesting is you hear people debating this morning even, is General Kelly the right guy to sort out the White House? One of the obvious points is generals are very good at bringing discipline to the people below them in a big system. But how good are they at bringing sort of discipline to the people above them? Mm. And maybe the problem in this White House is the guy at the very top, and his discipline is harder to bring under control.
So your job is to interpret what's happening in Washington for the Economist Global readership. What are you going to say? I mean, what's your sense of what's going on?
Well, this is the thing is, you know, on the one hand, Twitter is full of people making kind of mooch jokes and it's all very funny. But, you know, even in his short tenure, you could see foreign governments trying to understand what this said about the direction of the White House on big issues in which a lot of the world has a stake. So, for example, in his incredibly brief tenure, Anthony Scaramucci did give an interview to the BBC, which made news in Britain because it was about the free trade deal that Britain is desperate to sign with the United States because we're about to leave the European Union. So whether Donald Trump is open to free trade deals is a big, important question for the UK. You look at where Vice President Pence is today. He's just left Estonia, where he was reassuring NATO allies that this is still the kind of America that stands by NATO allies. He's on his way to Georgia, again, looking at sort of reassuring people that Russian aggression will not be tolerated, that there isn't some weird pro-Russian president in charge in the White House. So we here in Washington, we're all enjoying a kind of afternoon of Twitter jokes. The rest of the world does need America to play that familiar role on all sorts of fronts, whether it's trade or national security.
How did Scaramucci deal with the rest of that BBC interview on trade? Did he go off script at all?
It was not a wholehearted success. There was the moment where he said that being from Long Island, he and the president shared a distaste for backstabbers, that he was a front stabber kind of guy. And that was obviously that's been proved true because he's just been stabbed in the front by General Kelly. He also compared the American Revolution to the founding of Uber, saying that America was in a way a disruptive startup by a bunch of rich guys, which obviously is not something the Brits are used to hearing about the overthrow of George III, but, you know, it's a description. So I think basically, you know, people are going to be laughing for about 10 seconds. And then the familiar kind of worry is actually, is this White House going to look more normal? Is it going to be less chaotic? All of the big worries that people in Congress have, people around the rest of the world have, they don't actually want this chaos to be, you know, day in, day out. You know, it's no longer funny.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine liberals here having some schadenfreude or secret glee, or maybe not even so secret glee at the chaos in the White House. But this has got to be doing some serious damage to America's standing in the world right now.
That's right. And the fact that this is the director of communications, you could think, well, you know, does that matter very much? But actually, one of the fundamental problems with this American administration is the world's most powerful man, we don't actually know what he thinks about a range of really important issues. And, you know, you have the North Koreans firing off their latest test missile. You have the Iranians trying to fire off test missiles. You have tension with China. You have Donald Trump tweeting things that produced a very sharp reaction from the Chinese government over the weekend, where he was essentially linking his resentment about China's trade policies with his resentment about China not helping on the North Korean nuclear dossier. So the fact that the president of America is tweeting these things out, which is then creating facts on the ground in China, that kind of communications dossier is much more than just who stands behind the podium at the press briefing. America doesn't communicate clearly what kind of country it is right now, and that's really serious.
David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We talk about religious tolerance here in the U.S., but there is still a religious divide. If you have doubts about that, here's a statistic consider from a recent Pew Research poll. Half of those surveyed said that Islam is not part of mainstream American society. Polling also suggests that a lot of Americans don't know any Muslims and don't know much about Islam. And many people surveyed are suspicious of those who practice the Islamic faith. With that in mind, one Muslim writer has an idea based in theology for bridging the divide, the one between Islam and Christianity. The World's Matthew Bell sat down to talk with him.
Newcomers to the Quran are in for some surprises. Get this. The Prophet Muhammad is only mentioned a few times. And the prophet whose name most frequently appears in the Quran? It's Moses. Yes, the same Moses from the book of Exodus. There are also no women mentioned by name in the Quran, except for one. And that would be Mary, the mother of you-know-who. In fact, there's a whole chapter about her. This Iranian film called Saint Mary came out in 2000. It tells the Quranic story of the mother of Jesus. In the final scene, spoiler alert, Mary is holding her newborn son, and she's being confronted by high priests accusing her of being impure. That's when baby Jesus speaks up in his mother's defense, performing a miracle that never shows up in the New Testament. This is from the English dubbed version of the film.
I am Jesus, the Savior, a servant of God. He has given me a book and honored me with prophethood and blessed me wherever I may be.
Jesus, it turns out, is mentioned quite a few times in the Quran, and broadly speaking, the Quranic version of Jesus and of Mary too is very similar to what's in the Bible. Mustafa Akyol is a Turkish writer and a devout Muslim. He picked up a copy of the New Testament for the first time about 15 years ago, and this is what struck him about it.
I said, I noticed from the Quran, the birth of Jesus. And when I read the Gospel of Luke and how, Mary was promised by the angel that she will have a blessed son and without any men touching her, I said, wow, that is the Quranic chapter of Mary. It's so similar.
Akyol says he started underlining stuff in the New Testament that he agreed with as a Muslim. It turned out to be a lot of stuff, like the descriptions of Jesus as a prophet of God. This is very much part of mainstream Islamic teaching, but Akyol goes a step further.
I'm saying, let's learn about Jesus by reading the New Testament as well. When you read the Quran, you read about the miracles, you read about the virgin birth, you read that Jesus was the Word of God, a very powerful term. He was the Messiah. These are emphasized. But you don't find the Sermon on the Mount, for example. You don't find the critique of the Pharisees or other, the trends in times of Jesus. You don't get the whole story.
And this is the basis for Akyol's new book, The Islamic Jesus, How the King of the Jews Became a Prophet of the Muslims. He admits that calling on Muslims to think more about Jesus and even read Christian scripture might be too much for some Muslims, but he says this is something the Quran itself recommends.
The Quran repeatedly speaks of Jews and Christians as the people of the book. And in one verse, it says, go and ask them.
But when it comes to Jesus, there's also a bright red line in the Quran. Here's what it says. The Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was nothing more than a messenger of God. This means, of course, that ultimately Christians and Muslims do not agree on the nature of Jesus. Celine Ibrahim says this is important. She's a Muslim chaplain at Tufts University, and lately Ibrahim has been speaking with church groups about Islam and the Muslim understanding of Jesus. But she says there are more theological similarities than differences between the Islamic and Christian understanding of Jesus. By the way, she refers to Jesus by his Arabic language name, Isa.
For me, as a Muslim, when I try to explain this connection that I can personally feel with the Prophet Isa, alayhi salam, peace be upon him, then I explain how the Quran talks about him as the Word of God and how, what does that mean? That's a very miraculous thing that is beyond my possible comprehension. I also talk about how the Quran talks about him as one drawn near. And so this idea really resonates with a Christian audience, with all the imagery of sitting at the right hand of the Father.
Author Mustafa Akyol, who's on a fellowship at Wellesley College, says he's gotten a lot of positive feedback on his book, but he's had criticism from some fellow Muslims.
I got one harsh criticism in Turkey, and from a newspaper that I call Hardcore Islamic Nationalists. They want to deny everything that is Western, quote-unquote, and Christian, quote-unquote. So they were not happy with the fact that, you know, I referred to the New Testament. But in return, I would say, well, I'm referring to the New Testament because the Quran values the New Testament. That's why I value it as a Muslim.
Remember, Akhil says, Jesus was a Jewish reformer. For Christians, he's the Son of God, and he's seen by Muslims as a singular prophet. Sure, there are plenty of geopolitical tensions dividing the three Abrahamic monotheistic faiths, Akhil says, but they still have a lot to learn from each other. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
It's hard to fathom, but the conflict in Syria has been raging now for more than 6 years. It's claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, not to mention the millions of people displaced from their homes. Among those who have become refugees, members of the Orchestra of Syrian Musicians. We've reported on them before here on the show. The orchestra brings together Syrian musicians from all over, some still in Syria, some, as I just mentioned, living in exile. The ensemble recently played at the WOMAD Music Festival in southern England. One of the singers, Hansa Monif, spoke with our friends at the BBC.
All of us believe that the sound of music will be more louder than any sound in the world. Even the war, even the people who are shouting, this is our ID. Where you go, you can sing, people can feel you. That's it. It's 6 years of war, it's not easy for anyone to leave. Sometimes you feel like full of hope and everything will be fine, everything will be fixed, but sometimes you feel down. But even though, when I was in Syria, bombs everywhere, and I had a concert in Opera House. I was singing in Opera House in Syria and Damascus. Even the theater was full. I can't believe that. When I was thinking, oh my God, it's so dangerous. I feel like this, how much we are strong. All these people come under the bombs and, you know, it's war. You are lucky if you don't get the bombs, you know? So when people start coming, you feel we are very good people.
Are you hopeful of returning to Syria one day soon?
Of course. No one wants to live in his neighbor's house. Even your neighbor, very good with you. He's so friendly, he say welcome, and even he give you his house. You feel this is not mine. But no one want to move from their bedroom. We are talking about a home, about a country. Yeah, one day, I hope, please God, one day I believe that the war will stop. Nothing will be forever. Do you think the war will be forever? Of course not. So I think I'm here and my heart there.
Singer Hansa Monif of the Orchestra of Syrian Musicians. She was speaking there with the BBC during a stop in England. I'm Marco Werman with The World. There is no let-up to the turmoil in Venezuela. Just a day after Sunday's controversial vote, Venezuela's attorney general is refusing to accept the new constituent assembly. She called it an expression of dictatorial ambition. The new body will have the power to rewrite the constitution and disband the opposition-controlled National Assembly. Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, called it the biggest vote since his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, was swept to power. Today, the U.S. government announced sanctions targeting Maduro for threatening his country's democracy. But Maduro says the opinion of the U.S. is irrelevant.
Ha dicho hoy un vocero del gobierno del emperador.
Maduro said today a spokesperson for Emperor Donald Trump said the U.S. would not recognize the results of Venezuela's constituent National Assembly election. Why the hell should we care what Trump says? Maduro continued. But it's not just the U.S. that's condemning the vote. The European Union has said it has grave doubts about its validity. And EU spokeswoman Mina Andreeva also says EU officials are troubled by reports of several deaths during the election yesterday.
The European Union deeply regrets the violence and unrest during yesterday's election. All sides must refrain from violence. The government of Venezuela has a responsibility to ensure respect for the rule of law and fundamental rights such as freedom of expression and the right to peacefully demonstrate.
That was EU spokeswoman Mina Andreeva. Finally today, we learned of the deaths of two acting greats today, the American playwright and actor Sam Shepard at the age of 73 and French actress Jeanne Moreau, age 89, both independent people and actors who had their own unique ways with the craft. I got a good sense of Moreau's independence during an interview she gave a few years ago to Terry Gross on Fresh Air, and she was talking about why solitude was a good thing for her, even in her 70s.
That's so good sometimes, just to spread oneself in one's bed, get up at whatever time you wish. There are lots of pleasures.
Jeanne Moreau was an icon of the French New Wave. Orson Welles worked with her on several movies, and he once called her the greatest actress in the world. Our friend Adeline Sia grew up watching Moreau's films in France, and Adele says she always thought there was something special about her.
You know, she wasn't sort of this classic pretty actress. She had great beauty, but, you know, she had this sort of pouty mouth and also this raspy voice that everyone knew very well. I mean, it was really iconic. And so she really stood out in the crowd of other actresses. You know, certainly she's basically from almost the same generation of Brigitte Bardot. Actually, she made movies with Brigitte Bardot, but she stood out in a different way. She was more the intellectual, more the introspective kind of actress. And also, I think she really didn't care what people thought. You know, she just went for very audacious roles. Probably one of the most important roles of her career is with the François Truffaut film, Jules and Jim. As you know, this is about a love triangle, and this was really bold in 1962 to talk about ménage à trois, right?
Well, it's important to note, as you noted, she was an actress who didn't care what people thought, and this is a great example of one of her films that was risque. And yeah, so when you were a girl watching this and you hear the term ménage à trois, what did that mean to you as a kid?
I don't remember exactly what it meant to me as a teenager, but I can say that, you know, there was something about the film was also, it was sexual, obviously, but it was also just a great love story between three people. And there's a great song from the movie called Le Tourbillon des Jours, which she sang really simply, and it's really an iconic song, and certainly it will stay with people.
Elle avait des bagues à chaque doigt, des tas de bracelets autour des poignets, et puis elle chantait avec une voix qui cite au manjola.
The great Jeanne Moreau singing there in François Truffaut's Jules et Jim. The other thing that I noticed today, there's a famous photo of Jeanne Moreau circulating, Adele, of her sometime in the 50s with Miles Davis. She's trying to play his trumpet. Do you know what was going on there?
Yes, she was one of the main characters in the 1958 film Elevator to the Gallows by Louis Malle. And so it's this perfect murder plot that unravels when the murderer, who's Jeanne Moreau's lover in the story, is trapped in an elevator after having killed her husband, and they were going to run away together. And so she doesn't know what happened to him. And we see her for the longest part of the movie wandering around the streets of the city, wondering where her lover is. And, I mean, it's just her face, sort of desperate face. And we hear in the background the music by Miles Davis, who improvised the soundtrack for that film overnight. And Jeanne Moreau was present when they did that. And this was the beginning of the French New Wave in cinema, and Miles Davis created some of those most iconic jazz music ever. So it's really something that if you study movies and cinema at all, you have to see this one.
There's this musical theme in Jeanne Moreau's life. Her mother was a dancer. Her father was a hotel owner. The story is that when she told him she wanted to be an actress, he slapped her. But she actually credits his resistance to her success. Here's Jeanne Moreau again in an interview from 1993 with Terry Gross.
all my life, I always tried to prove to him that I was right. You know, it's funny. It gave me such an impulse. In fact, it helped me.
Adele, where do you see that fire, that defiance in her work?
Well, certainly. I mean, first of all, she had a very long career, and she talked about this, her father being her against being a performer and actress a lot. She actually credited him for basically goading her on. You know, she just wanted to do this probably because she had been forbidden to do so. She was very rebellious. So I think, yeah, sometimes it's good to have someone who says no to you because you just want that thing even more so.
The world's Adeline Sia in Paris. Before I let her go, I asked Adele if there was one Jeanne Moreau moment that stays with her. And she told me about this song that's been stuck in her head all day today.
It's called J'ai la mémoire qui flanche, which means my memory's failing. And it's kind of a funny song about a woman who's trying to remember her lover, but she can't remember his name and where his eyes blue or gray. I'm not sure. It's a very playful song. And in a way, it kind of shows, you know, her being very carefree in her life.
J'ai la mémoire qui flanche, je me souviens plus très bien. Comme il était très musicien, il jouait beaucoup des mains. Tout entre nous a commencé par un très long baiser. Sur la veine bleutée du poignet, un long baiser sans fin.
The late great Jeanne Moreau from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us today.
Et quel était son nom? Il s'appelait, je l'appelais, comment l'appelait-on? Pourtant c'est fou ce que je m'ai l'appelé par son nom.
PRI, Public Radio International.